The hour of 1 o'clock having arrived, I'll call this meeting of the House Ag Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order. We have a quorum, and again, Representative Gander is with us via Zoom today. Looking at the minutes, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes, but also note that Representative Gottfried was here as a member, and if the minutes could be corrected and then approved with that in it.
You can't put this one in your scrapbook then, Representative. Anyway, with that correction, all those in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Approve, disapprove, same sign. The minutes are adopted. Thank you. We have several bills on the agenda. The plan is to lay all of them over. First up is House File 1621, Representative Van Binsbergen. First of all, Representative, congratulations on your son's team being in the state basketball tournament consolation champs, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, fifth place in AA boys basketball. It was a lot of fun.
Very good. Let's get on to business. I would move for you House File 1621. Representative Van Binsbergen, tell us about your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for agreeing to hear House File 1621 this afternoon. A few weeks ago, I learned about an exciting project that is happening in my district. The project involves the use of sugar beet pulp to make a fiber-based packaging material that can completely replace PFAS and plastic containers. The pulp is a byproduct from the sugar manufacturing process. Minnesota is the number one sugar beet production in the country, and so there is ample supply of pulp here. One of those sugar beet factories is in my district. The company that has developed this product is called CelluComp. House File 1621 provides a grant to CelluComp to help construct a scalable plant that will include a biogas digester. Their desire to make this product in Minnesota is timely, since the PFAS ban that was passed by the legislature in 2023 became effective just a couple months ago. Their unique product can replace PFAS that was once used in food packaging material. With me today to explain their project in great detail is the CEO of CelluComp, Christian Griffin, and the president of CelluComp, Chris Poltz. I'll turn it over to them.
Welcome. Identify yourselves, whoever's going to go first, and proceed with your testimony.
All right. I'll proceed. My name is Christian Kemp Griffin, and I'm the CEO of CelluComp. We have a presentation. I'm not sure if it's up live.
Yep, we're plugged in. I'm just not sure if it's...
Just see if we can get that hooked up to the monitor.
Yeah, why don't you start it with...
There we go.
There you go.
There we go. Okay. We're all set. Okay. So I'd like to introduce our company, CelluComp. And our mission is to create material change for good. That's significant change, using our materials for the good of... from now on, and for the good of the people, planet, and profit. So let me just go to the next slide. So we all know that there is a big problem out there in terms of plastic everywhere in the oceans, in our bodies, in the soil. And there's a big PFAS problem in the world as well. And this is uncontestable at this point, and a lot of people are trying to find solutions in order to get rid of this problem. So the problem is when it comes to packaging, the problem is that plastic is actually a very good material. It's cheap. It has good barrier, but it's not what we want. And if you try to go to fiber, if you try to go to paper-based products, the problem is that it's very porous, naturally, and unless you put something in it properly, it will go soggy and wet. And so you need to have the barrier on the one hand, and you want to have fiber on the other hand. So we provide a solution in order to make things have the barrier and also be in fiber. So CelluComp is a microfibrillated cellulose. So what we do is we go in and we grab the very small nanofibers inside plant cell walls, in particular in root vegetables. So think carrots, potatoes, or sugar beet. And we produce a product that's called curran. Curran is the Gaelic word for carrot. And with curran, we put it inside a substrate. That means if you have a bottle, for instance, like this, it goes in as an additive inside this substrate, and it also goes into coatings. And here we call our coating reef, like the Great Barrier Reef. And so these fibers are embedded both in the substrate and the coating, and when you do that, you have fiber-based barrier packaging. So we believe that you can make actually any packaging from fiber. So that's converting metal or glass or plastic into fiber-based. We deal with a full value chain of people. This is people making, there's incredible amount of innovation in terms of machine and designing in this area. So we work heavily with them. We work heavily with the global brands as well as the converters and material suppliers in order to develop our material. And we do this through promotion, of course. Here we are at PAC Expo displaying and launching the first ever water bottle made from fiber. So why Minnesota? Our ideal location is here for a number of reasons. One is we found it a very nice environment in terms of the people we've met and the organizations that we've worked with so far, be that sort of the group at Economic Development, the farming community, as well as some of the institutes that help work on these types of products. It's very important to know that in Minnesota is the only place in the world where they actually freeze their sugar beets. And because they freeze their sugar beets, it means that the factories are running much longer in the year compared to almost anywhere else in the world. And this is a great advantage to us because we can get the fresh pulp and use that fresh pulp for our material and synergize with the factory at the same time. It's also a market that's very where you have a good business community of global brands that are responsible and want sustainable development. There's very, very close to papermaking in Wisconsin and also in this state, and to food production in Illinois, which is not that far away. So it's an ideal place from a source of material and ideal from a customer base. So we have found a location in Renville. It's beside the biggest sugar beet plant in North America, I believe, Southern Minnesota Beet Sugar Cooperative in Renville. And here this is where we have chosen to build our factory. And would like to do that as soon as possible. It's about 1 mile away from the sugar beet factory. In fact, there's actually a pipe that joins that factory right to our building, which means that we can use a lot of their water and back and forth and share, synergize with steam and other aspects of our organization. This may seem like a complicated slide, but it's very important. So what, just to mention, is this is a very circular economy component. So you have the sugar beet. With the sugar beet, after the sugar process is done, you have this pulp. With the pulp, we run it through our factory and we make curran. But in addition to that, we provide a waste stream. So we have a co-product stream from the sugar beet factory. We have a waste stream afterwards, and that waste stream is also valuable. It's also valuable as a fertilizer, it's valuable as an animal feed, and it can be converted into biogas. So really what you're doing now is you're taking a co-product or waste stream from industry that already exists, and you're utilizing that, both producing energy and valuable materials. So for example, we would like to take this material and make, for instance, sugar bags. So if you can imagine, you have the sugar company that is selling their sugar in bags made from their co-product stream. So we are looking at a scale-up here. We have already started the initiation of the first part of the factory that will be built by the end of May. But in order for us to reach scale and to get the biogas going and to make this a really viable factory, this is why we're coming to the Minnesota Senate and House for your support to allow us to build this factory at full scale. So we believe that this is a viable project for Minnesota because it helps rid the PFAS issue that is longstanding in this state, and I know that this state has taken a leadership position in trying to reduce that. It will give Minnesota the opportunity to take a lead position on developing a whole new series of packaging away from plastics as well, and take a national but also a global leadership position in developing this new way of doing packaging. So our plan down the road is to drive up to 80,000 tons of sugar beet pulp to reduce greenhouse gases as well and have a PFAS future. We will hire at the very beginning 20 people into the factory, and this, as we scale up, will grow with time depending on the volume that we have, which is a lot of people in a very small community like Renville. So thank you very much. I'll leave it there and take questions if there are any.
Let's wait for our second testifier and then we'll have questions. Thank you, Mr. Kemp Griffin. Mr. Platts, identify yourself and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a whole lot to add necessarily to the presentation, like I said, I'm a kind of a long-standing Minnesota native. I grew up about 20 or 25 minutes away from Renville, so this is a chance for me to get back to Minnesota and develop a region that I'm very, very much tied to at this point.
Thank you. Anybody in the audience who would care to comment or testify on this bill, House File 1621? Seeing none, let's open it up to questions from members. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. And so when you were going through this presentation, it sounds like you're asking us for funding for facilities, which is, you know, typically, you know, relating to capital infrastructure and whatnot. And so can you tell us, you know, traditionally, if you go through the capital investment committee that I'm the co-chair of, we ask, you know, what is the matching fund that you have for this? What is the total project cost? And what is the $10 million buying for the state of Minnesota? Thank you.
For Kim Griffin.
Yeah, so the bill, which is originated in the Senate, I believe, is for $10 million. And we have already invested $15 million into the company. You're putting another $4.5 million in a current capital raise right now, which so that's the ratio of how the financing will work for this factory.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what is the $10 million buying the state of Minnesota? Is this for construction? Is this for designing, pre-design, engineering?
This is for Griffin. taking the project to scale and to adding the biogas component. So we need additional equipment for that. We also need to make it food safe approved, which will require some outfits into the building and some additional equipment in order to make it viable for the market.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And last follow-up. And so are you a registered for-profit entity or nonprofit, or what is the status of your organization?
Our organization is a for-profit company, and we are a startup, however. Yeah.
Representative Lee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just the last comments, you know, we've been hearing all session long about how we don't want to put funding into, you know, nonprofit entity, but this is the second time that we have seen a for-profit entity coming before the committee to ask for funding for us. And so let's try to be consistent as we talk through, you know, which organization or whatnot do we fund this year in the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Further comments for Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And last Friday, the legislative auditor had a audit on deed grants and direct earmarks to legislatively directed earmarks were highlighted again as something that we shouldn't do, that there should be competitive grants. And, you know, here's a case where we're asking for $10 million. I don't think we will have $10 million for a for-profit company when we've got other things happening in our state and in our country. That doesn't mean it's not a worthy project. And, you know, maybe working with AURI or the University of Minnesota or other sources of revenue, Compere or local banks. But we will have to prioritize, and this is a hard one to do when we have to provide some basic things.
Comment or follow-up? Either one of you?
No.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. And, I thank you for bringing this bill forward and, you know, kind of for the idea as well. I mean, you're probably not the first one that's had an idea of making fiber out of or, you know, container out of something. But I think, one of the challenges we hear oftentimes around here is, you know, the negatives about something that we're currently using. And, we don't have the answers for solutions. And, you know, we can't just have food sitting on a shelf with no package. But I think, one of the great things about this is having a, you know, here's an alternative to a product that we know has long-term harm and, PFAS. And I think having, you know, the research and stuff behind this is, you know, is great to see. And, I appreciate seeing solutions come forward. And, I know the budget is tight, but, it's good to see research happening to find solutions instead of, just continue looking at the problems and there being no answer. But I just want to applaud you guys for the research and everything that has happened behind this to really bring a solution to the table. So thank you.
Thank you.
And I would just add that, funding aside, this is an extremely interesting project and that you've chosen Minnesota to come up to scale. Is good for sugar beets, it's good for farmers, it's good for the state, it's good for your company. And I would encourage you to continue and look for every available funding source that could be available here in Minnesota. And with that, any final thoughts, Representative?
Just want to thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for committee members for listening. I think this is an important solution to the problem. And thank you very much for your time today.
With that, Representative Vance Binsbergen calls for House File 1621 to be held over.
Thank you.
Next up, House File 1701, Representative Nelson, Minnesota Fertilizer Grant Program, Minnesota Made Grant Program established and the money appropriated. Representative Nelson, to your bill.
All right, House File 1701. Move that before the committee. And so this here, House File 1701, it would be a grant program for a Minnesota Made Fertilizer Program. And so much like we heard in the previous bill, where we're taking a co-product or a byproduct of a manufacturing process, we'd be able to take and make the do some of the same things, but using it as a fertilizer product instead, and that's one of the areas that is able to make a Minnesota-made fertilizer. And so I think it's really trying to be resourceful and making use of our co-products that we have when we're coming to different manufacturing processes around food. So with that, I would like to turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Randy Terstig. I'm from Olivia, Minnesota. I'm part of a family farming operation, and I also have significant experience in operating non-typical fertilizer operations. I'm here to tell you today how important it is for Minnesota, as well as the rest of the Midwest, to find alternatives to traditional imported fertilizers. The state of Minnesota has over 20 million acres of farmland, and If you take a look at the nutrient removal charts, I'm not sure I had enough, but I think some of those were handed out to committee members. They're kind of an interesting chart. If you just slide those up, and if you just use, for example, say a 200 bushel per acre corn crop, that'll show you the amount of nutrients that are removed from each acre of farmland in the state of Minnesota. Significant amount. For example, the average removal on 200 bushel corn crop would be about 80 pounds of phosphorus. A 50 bushel soybean crop is about 42 pounds of phosphorus, and a 5 ton alfalfa crop would remove about 300 pounds of potassium. It's very simple. These nutrients, if they're removed, they need to be replaced. If you don't replace these nutrients, our soil just becomes more depleted and depleted over time, and production will decrease. So for many reasons now more than ever, Minnesota should be fully utilizing all available nutrients as crop fertilizers. Due to worldwide contention with nutrient-producing countries, our farmers' crop inputs are at risk. First of all, I'll talk about potassium. Potassium is a key element in crop fertilizers, and it's typically supplied by purchasing potash, which is approximately 60% potassium. The U.S. produced less than 1% of total global potash production in 2023, and over the last 5 years, U.S. potash imports have ranged from $2.5 billion in 2020 to over $6 billion in 2022. Prices for fertilizer peaked in 2022 due to the effects of the Ukraine-Russia war. And so about, oops, let's get a little too close maybe. So U.S. sources potash primarily from Canada, accounting for more than 80% of total imports since 2020. Russia and Belarus are the next largest supporters, importers to us at about 15%. So another concern is farmers are increasingly concerned about not having access to fertilizer in a timely manner. Significant amount of our fertilizer moves up the water on the river. The frequency of low water on the river is more concerning each and every year. Having nutrient plants in Minnesota helps eliminate that concern, knowing the product is being produced in Minnesota and sitting in warehouses in close proximity. So what am I talking about? I'm not talking about digging holes in mining products. Minnesota has a supply of many products that are produced as co-products of other streams. Some of these include animal manures from both large and small facilities, calcium products from sugar beet production, potassium from wood ash, and many biological additives from production facilities, many of which are being underutilized today. Unfortunately, many times the companies that produce these products can simply not afford the equipment and means to make a viable fertilizer product out of them. So if you can get enough of those companies that could be combined into one, they can blend and mix those and justify the equipment and costs that go into further processing. Several Minnesota-made fertilizer and nutrient plants could be built that accumulate these products and further process these into friendly products and complete blends that allow for single-pass fertilization. So I've been asked, why is it important to blend these products? Farmers, especially in Minnesota, in the past many years, fertilizers were applied in the fall. The farmer concerns of runoff and wind erosion and infiltration, that process is really becoming a thing of the past. It's frowned upon, and farmers don't like to fall apply any more nutrients than what they have to. And so they want a one application rate, so when they come to the spring and they're going to apply, they want to do it in one pass. They can't afford to take six different products and make six different applications on that same type of soil. So not only does that create extra cost, but every trip the farmer makes on that land creates extra compaction and creates more problems for producing a good crop. So if these facilities receive the type of nutrients I mentioned earlier, they can process, mix, and have a perfect blend of these products available for the farmers to continue to incorporate all their needs in one pass. These products can also be pelletized or compacted to provide much more efficient hauling and spreading of the products in the field. So there are many other benefits, co-product benefits to this as well. It could very well be an operational benefit to the company that is producing the raw materials. Sometimes products that are safe to use as a fertilizer may end up in landfills because the producing company doesn't have another outlet. Second, including a reduction in field stockpiling of certain manures and other products, that helps reduce wind, water runoff, and complaints from neighbors and residential areas. Third, these types of fertilizer and plants have a significant nutrient advantage over regular N, P, and K mine products because they also have micronutrients. The micronutrients are directly correlated to the food we eat, the feed we give our animals. If the crops we feed ourselves and to the animals are deficient in micronutrients, it's just a steady stream. They don't go back into soil. So by reutilizing those same types of products back into the soil, it makes a really nice crop nutrient circle. Fourth, these smaller facilities can fulfill the needs of specialty crops and gardens. There is a huge shortage of quality nutrient products available for people with gardens. Just this last month alone, we received a phone call from a company that they offer that service to homeowners. They'll actually come out and test their gardens and make soil recommendations. But then the large traditional fertilizer plants, they're not equipped to deal and package products for those smaller growers. So these types of plants are a fantastic source for those smaller gardens, truck farm type operations to utilize, as well as mushroom production companies. The mushroom production companies seem to be increasing. These plants can make fantastic fertilizer products for mushrooms to grow in as well. So market fluctuations in the fertilizer business are greatly related to energy costs. A huge amount of the fertilizer that's brought into the United States, probably 60 to 75% of the cost of that fertilizer is energy related. So obviously if it's energy related, it's not a green fertilizer. It's not an environmentally great practice. So anything we can utilize, manufacture here, it's just a win-win for everyone associated to it. So the marketing techniques on these plants, farmers, gardeners, everyone today understands the need for nutrient replacement as well as biological activity to be added to their soil. Traditional NPK fertilizers do not promote biological activity in the soil. That's where you want to use manures, compost, those types of products that really make your soil healthy and make it thrive and produce healthy crops and food for us. So at a minimum, farmers typically will use a chart like I handed out again, and they'll utilize that for the next year. So they'll say, if they removed 200 bushels of corn last year, they'll look at that chart and say, okay, if I remove 200 bushels of corn, these are many nutrients at a minimum I should replace if I want to keep my soil in the same health that it was the previous year. So the general business plan of these works really well. The disadvantage of these plants is the equipment costs are high. Most of these plants would have to be equipped, and I'm talking small plants to be clear. I'm talking several plants that are, you know, maybe in that $2 to $5 million range. But these plants would probably be equipped with possibly dryers or pelletizers or blenders just to mix and blend and really utilize these products that are available in the state of Minnesota today, that many of which are being underutilized. So the funds I'm asking for, or the help that this bill could offer some producers, it's not only for myself. I know there's some other areas in the state of Minnesota. I'm sure there's some other people that would look at this as an opportunity and say, yeah, we could, if we had some help, we could build one of these plants and receive some of these co-products from factories or food plants that are in our area. So I think it would be well received. It could help several of these small little facilities start and get off the ground and just be a win-win all the way around. So today I'm asking you to support the bill to move along the Minnesota Made Fertilizer Products Bill. And I certainly welcome any questions.
Thanks, Mr. Terstig. Just a clarification. You talked about the one-pass system. And to be clear, you're referring to potassium and phosphorus and not nitrogen in that one-pass system, correct?
Yes, thank you, Chair, for the question. That's correct. Most of these types of products have small amounts of nitrogen. And if they do have nitrogen, it's usually in an organic form of nitrogen. So when it's applied to the soil, it's a slow release type thing that breaks down with biological activity over the next growing season. So percentage-wise, the majority of this nitrogen applied from these products would be very, very small. Typically today, farmers, you know, have become more knowledgeable, better stewards of the land, and realize that nitrogen needs to be applied in the spring right before the crop is planted, or majority of it is done actually while the crop is growing today.
Thank you. Anybody in the audience who would care to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, let's open it up to member questions on House File 1701. Representative Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the handy calculator. Can use that. One of the things with micronutrients, though, beyond application is availability, and the availability can be impacted by pH, which is impacted by liming, which farmers have been using forever, I guess, would be the right. So I think that might be something just to help out with education. You know, if there's new folks that are coming in, is
the importance of pH management and availability, and certain crops have that micronutrient need, particularly alfalfa. But, you know, I had a town meeting this weekend, and I had a lot of people show up, and I had some, even had some Republicans show up in my town meeting, and they were concerned about more spending. But what united kind of the Democrats and the Republicans in there was not wanting spending for private businesses. And that in tough times that providing subsidies for private businesses, whether they be a stadium or something else, there was quite a bit of opposition to that. So at least this is a grant program where there, I'm assuming, Representative Nelson, it would be competitive. Is that correct?
Representative Nelson?
Yes, that is my understanding. This is, you know, it's not a named recipient, that it would be a competitive grant to whoever would apply.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But it would be grants to private businesses. And again, when we're in tough times and going to be talking about what programs probably are cut across the board in state government, you know, I think those constituents are probably correct in not wanting to be spending precious tax dollars on private entities.
Any further comments? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Nelson, for bringing this. And this may be a question for either one of you. Is it Mr. Turnstate? Am I saying that?
Turnstate, yes.
Turnstate, okay, sorry. Apologize for that. So this does seem, obviously, with the unknown global state of fertilizer sourcing, right, and the unknown with tariff war being on and off, as well as things that are happening in Eastern Europe, you know, there is some uncertainty in the market. So I understand sort of the need for this grant program. My question is about there's not a lot of parameters in the bill as it's currently written. Specifically, I'm thinking, I mean, we mentioned a lot about new companies who are starting up, who are maybe opening facilities or buying new equipment. Now, in some ways, we already subsidize that with some of our sales tax exemptions in our tax code. But also, this grant doesn't really specify that it has to go with people who are just starting out. And I guess my question is, there are companies currently who do Minnesota-made fertilizer and are doing so for profit and are, you know, doing it for various levels of success, depending on the company. I mean, would they be eligible for this grant simply to continue doing what they are currently doing? And I'd be concerned about funds going there rather than, as you're specifying, new retailers or new factories or new facilities. Is there any check on that happening when, if this grant is processed?
Mr. Terstein.
Sure. I would say that, in my view, of course, I'm not the one that would have the final definitions of what that grant would look like, but my view would be to say that if someone is already in business and has a good plan to expand or to show how they could demonstrate utilizing more products that are being produced in the state that are being underutilized today, I would assume that they should be eligible just as well as a new producer would be. And I'd also like to stress that we're not talking about producing fertilizer for just farmers. As I mentioned, that garden market, recreational market, I think it's referred to in some aspects, and the truck garden market is, it's just a win-win and really a fast payback that is used by many, many you know, people in the public space as well today.
And follow-up, Representative Smith.
Yeah, I'll be brief. Thank you, Chair. I understand why those businesses would want a grant program like this, right? And when you're a competitive business, any advantage you can get. But from a state perspective, is I guess what I'm arguing with is I see there much more advantage with getting new things off the ground than helping existing companies along these lines. I think I'll just leave it by saying, emphasizing what a couple other members have saying, which is when we're giving to private corporations, especially for-profit corporations, we want to be careful that there's good parameters to make sure the state is getting a benefit from that. But also that I think I'd want in this bill language some more parameters that the department would have some guidance on is I think what I would offer as feedback. Other than that, thank you for this bill presentation. As I said, I think that the need is there for this, maybe just some more clarifying language.
As a bill author, Representative Smith, Representative Nelson, I should say.
No, that wasn't a volunteer.
All right. Thank you, Chair Anderson. And, you know, and thank you for the comments. you know, as it is written, I don't see it, you know, being specified as being in, you know, any newer startup organizations. But yet at the same time, it's, you know, really taking a product that, you know, it's already here, and in many cases, or in some cases, they might be taking a product that's heading to an industrial landfill because it's some of these things that maybe be called industrial waste. You know, thinking of a cheese plant, you might have some potassium, you know, there might be something in cheese manufacturing process that could be able to be utilized, but yet, you know, some that cheese plant might not have the ability to get it distributed out, or it's not in a form that's really able to apply to a garden or a field or something like that. But if we can take somebody with that really can bring these products together and manufacture them into a product that can be, whether it's sold at you know, direct to consumers or through various outlets, can really utilize things and really, you know, I think growing up we learned recycle, reduce, reuse, and I think this is some of that, you know, making sure we're utilizing our products that we do have. And I do agree that the finances are not where we want to be in the state, and I think it's also it's important to be able to talk about these things because we are filling our landfills up, and if we can put some of these nutrients in the correct spot where they are and producing food instead of waste, I think it's a win for the state. So with that, I thank you for hearing the bill, and I'd encourage its support.
I would just add that both these bills are exciting, and that they show that entrepreneurs in the state are going to would like to take a waste product and make that into a usable product, and I think that cause is excellent. So with that, Representative Nelson, will you lay your bill over?
Yes, I move that lay my bill over.
Thank you. House File 1701 is laid over.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, you may as well stay there. House File 1796, Livestock Investment Grant Program Modifications. You have a couple of testifiers, okay. And you want to introduce your bill?
All right, House File 1796. I would move that before the committee.
Go ahead, Representative Nelson.
Okay, thank you. 1796. It's a livestock investment grant, and before we talk about the bill, there is the A1 amendment that I would like to move.
Okay, Representative Nelson has the A1 amendment. Would you care to explain what the amendment does?
Yes, the there's just a couple of language changes that it is doing, changing it from a person to an eligible applicant. It's changing the funding on lines 1.11, lowering the threshold down to 200,000, which would be an increased would lower it to the cost sharing down by about $20,000. And then also on lines 1.18, it would really clarify that the animals that are raised would really be for food and fiber and meat or breeding stock production.
To the amendment, Chair Nelson, Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson. You know, we are going to not oppose an author's amendment. We believe in the custom and usage of the Minnesota House that authors have the deference of getting the bill in the shape they would like. We could, we're not. We think we need to move on and try to build a bill together. It will take a majority to get out of this committee. But I just want to say we would support the author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like, which is the custom and usage of the Minnesota House.
Hearing that, all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. To the bill, Representative Nelson, as amended.
Okay. Thank you. The Livestock Investment Grant, it's been, I don't know how long it's been around, but it's been around for a number of years. But, various people all across the state have been able to benefit from this, livestock producers. And, you know, some of them are local producers. We've got some that are also on the One in my district is one that's a livestock dealer. You know, they sell, you know, buy and sell animals, and, you know, it's really been able to be a benefit to the whole community to be able to have that there. And the main thing that we're doing, you know, besides renewing it, it would be also raising the cap of it for the first 20,000, because it has been a 10% grant, up to 500,000. And so we're, one of the challenges, if you're looking for trying to do a small investment, and you're only getting, you're getting 10% of maybe $1,000, it's not a whole lot, and it's really not worth doing, it might not be worth doing the paperwork for the grant. But so we're on these smaller grants, we're raising that match up to 50,000, or 50%, not 50,000, 50%, and then 20% up to 200,000. And so that's really the main focus of the bill. And I'd like to turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tessa Sadai Parks, and I, along with my spouse Wyatt, own and operate WT Farms. We raise grass-finished beef, bottle calf to butcher, and certified organic hay on 100% rental ground, selling direct to consumer. I'm a member of the Land Stewardship Project, as well as president of the Rice County Chapter of the Minnesota Farmers Union, and on behalf of myself and these organizations, I would like to share my strong support for the proposed modifications to the Livestock Investment Grant. Wyatt and I started our farm in the spring of 2021, signing a lease for pasture with water and fencing and purchasing our first calves. As beginning and first-generation farmers on rented ground, we must rely on credit and restrict our investments to what we can take with us, necessities like a cattle trailer, haying equipment, and temporary fencing supplies. We can't afford to invest in spaces that we aren't sure we will be in once our lease is over. As the farm grew and we needed more than our off-farm income alone could afford, we looked at the Livestock Investment Grant to help get our business off the ground, but ultimately put our energy into applying for farm credit loans. Fast forward to now, we added 3 leases last year totaling over 90 acres, and on top of that, we are starting a land transition plan with one of those landowners. Though this is a huge step for us, the reason we can even hope to achieve land ownership is because it becomes with zero infrastructure, which creates more challenges for us to overcome. At minimum, the space needs a watering system, perimeter fencing, and a barn for keeping any livestock there. Thankfully, we are in the planning process, so we have some time to seek grant funds. However, without the changes proposed here, we wouldn't be able to use this program. On the other hand, bootstrapping projects like T-post fencing or a four-wheeler and trailer for hauling water would be either too small of a project or the value of reimbursement would not be worth the time and effort for applying. For a $4,000 project, we would still need to come up with $3,600 or spend additional time applying for a loan, time we would have even less of with fence installation and daily water hauling added to our plates. Putting it simply, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. I'll be honest, this is incredibly frustrating. We firmly believe all livestock farmers are worth investing in, and our state desperately needs more livestock on the land to improve and replenish the soil's health and ability to make us more resilient. Our livestock operation is small and still finding its way, but our impact on our local community and economy is significant, from purchasing our supplies at the town feed store to buying bull calves from the neighboring dairy. We are growing slowly because we have to make the financial decision to not take on more debt than we can afford, nor have an enterprise our current leases are unable to support. But we work hard, 365 days a year in all weather, and we know how that is as Minnesotans, driving 30 minutes one way to raise happy, healthy Minnesota beef. In conclusion, I very much appreciate that the Department of Agriculture has recognized the need for the proposed changes and strongly encourage passage of Representative Nelson's bill. Thank you for your time and for your work supporting farmers. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Parks. Any questions? Anybody in the audience? Anybody from the department here that could kind of give us a brief rundown of activity in the Livestock Investment Grant program? Thank you for coming up. Identify yourself and proceed.
For the record, my name is Courtney Vandermeer. I manage the Livestock Investment Grant for the Department of Agriculture. Chair Anderson, could you repeat your question?
Could you give us a little background of average size grants? It looks to me like we are reducing the maximum eligible from 500,000 down to 240,000 with this change. Could you comment on that? What type of applications do you get and how many go out?
Chair, committee members, currently the grant ranges between $400 to $25,000, so that's spending between $4,000 and $250,000. The agency does limit it at that cap of that $25,000 grant. Current projects probably average is around $17,000 for an average project, but we do have projects of all range. Anywhere from a barn to somebody doing something on the smaller side, but the smaller grants are getting that same 10%.
Okay. In the bill language that's crossed out, it mentions 500,000. Now you're saying the max is 250?
Correct. The chair, committee members, the agency does cap it at that, so spending 250,000. That has been our practice with the request for proposal.
Okay. And would it be safe to assume that these smaller size grants, as was mentioned, the squeeze wasn't worth the juice or something, that the grants awarded will be bigger, relatively speaking?
Chair, committee members, yes, the grants for smaller projects would be bigger. We do anticipate awarding more grants because it'd be more advantageous for those smaller projects to apply. So say somebody looking to make a smaller improvement, such as a new fence or a cattle chute or a watering system, may not apply right now because the documentation requirements are still the same to receive that 10% reimbursement.
Okay, thank you. And one last question before I turn it over to other people. On that 50% of the first 20,000, that means the participant would have to come up with 10,000 on their own, correct?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, thank you. Anybody in the audience? Questions from the panel? Representative Smith.
I have a question for the representative from the department. Obviously, I think the heart of this bill is about the administration of the grants itself. But I'm curious, does the department have an opinion on the change? So we're changing the definition of livestock with the amendment, which obviously is a big deal for the livestock investment grant. Previously, it looks like we had specified specific animals, and the new language is just opening it up to animals raised for the production of fiber, meat, and animal byproducts, and then says including but not limited to the animals that we already have in statute. Are you okay with that? Are you at all concerned of widening up that definition at all?
Courtney, I didn't catch your last name again.
Vandermeer.
Vandermeer?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
Chair, committee members, yes, this aligns with the department's recommendation. We do get requests for, say, rabbits, alpacas that are not included in the current language, so this would open it up to those type of livestock operations.
Representative Smith?
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Vanderbeek.
Yes,
is that right?
Correct.
Thank you for that. So, but the original bill does say rabbits, donkeys, alpacas. I assume that you're just thinking we'll take applications as they come and we can make the determination of animals that are outside these specific, whatever it is, 14 that are mentioned. That's the position of the administration.
Yeah.
Ms. Vandermeer?
Chair, committee members, we wanted to just, what came up, so aquaculture has been a topic, and it would fit that language. So opening up to any emerging species that do fit the definition of livestock.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you. And I may have missed part of that. We're hearing there's a resurgence this spring because of the price of eggs, of getting baby chicks. Would a small or medium-sized chicken operation qualify? Ms. Vandermeer.
Chair, committee members, yes, poultry is part of that.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from members of the committee? If not, Representative Nelson, closing statements.
Thank you for hearing this bill. And as we look at things of, it's important to have businesses across the our communities. They're either putting food or fiber back into the area and also just driving the economy. They're buying, they're shopping at our local supply stores, they're buying feed, they're also buying groceries and everything else and trying to keep everybody busy. It's important or going. I know a few years ago I was a dairy farmer in my former life and previous life. And, you know, they were showing that a dairy cow, she produced, for every dollar that she produced in production and through the community, it basically was this impact of seven times, you know, because I was buying stuff at a store, I was buying fencing equipment, and, you know, that rippled through that. And so, you know, this is just investing in livestock, it's helping invest in our communities. It's not just with the producer itself. So with that, I believe this bill is being laid over, so I would move that we lay the bill over.
House File 1796 is laid over. Thanks, Representative Nelson. Next up, House File 1676, Representative Burkill. Farm Survey Provisions Modified. A couple of testifiers, Tony Quillis, Brenda Hartkoff, and Tim Spreck. Representative Burkill, you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move that House File 1676 be laid over.
Go ahead with your bill.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1676 would address the fact that a landowner needs to, let me start over here. The bill would eliminate the requirement to record a certain form of deed with the county recorder. And it's just that plain and simple. If you go to...
And Representative Burkill, sorry to interrupt, but I think you have an amendment.
I do.
Well.
And I was just going to get to that.
I'm looking for it, too. It's the A1 amendment. Would you care to explain what your amendment does?
Go to page 2. And yeah, I'd like to move the A1 amendment now, if that's okay. Sure.
And would you explain it, please?
So the amendment would just simply delete the new language on line 4 and reinsert the stricken language in line 7 on page 2. And then after line 17, it would include the clause on clause 7. All notices recorded under section 35.155, subdivision 11, clause 7 expire as of the effective date of this bill. So it would just expire all notices from the title and abstract from the bill. So the Registrar of Titles must omit, and the rest of that line stays the same. The Registrar of Titles must omit an expired notice from the future certificates of title. So it just cleans up that language on the second page.
Okay. Some of us do.
Some of us do, some of us do not.
Okay.
Apologies.
Mr. Chair, that was the 1796, not the 1671.
Is this one right? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Does everyone have the amendment now?
Well, they have it. It's late.
Okay.
I apologize for that. Chair Hansen, should we pull the amendment?
Mr. Chair, maybe this is a good time to note that we have very limited committee time left. We are willing to, again, as I mentioned earlier, let this go on. But we also are looking for some assistance because we have one committee hearing left on the DFL side because of the way the calendar is laying and holidays. So in order to do work, we will support this, if you could again explain it for the record, to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
Appreciate that. And I think you're going to have two bill hearings left if we can work things out. But anyway, discussion on the A1 amendment. Seeing Representative Smith.
Yeah, I think just to be clear, Representative Burkill. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at this amendment now. I apologize. I was kind of scrambling to find it again. Could you give a overview one more time, and then I may have a question after that. But I apologize. We were trying to find the amendment language.
Sure.
Dense version, Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, my apologies for not having that in your packets, guys. So if you go to the amendment, the A1 would, on page 2, delete the and on line 4 and reinsert the and on line 7. And then on page 2 as well, on clause 7 under subdivision 11, and inserts the line, all notices recorded under section 35.155 subdivision 11 would expire as of effective date of this bill. In other words, all those notices expire prior. Make sense?
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, I wanted to make sure I did have that. Thank you for repeating that for me. I think I would just say I disagree with the substance of this amendment. I think these notices shouldn't expire. I think they should be. We should know where these are, and potentially people who purchase should know if this has happened in the past. But I'm going to vote yes on this amendment because I do think you deserve, this is your bill, to have it in the way that you want it. This is your bill. So just to be clear about this voting pattern.
Chair Hansen?
Proceed.
Okay, I thought you'd put your mic up. Did we approve the amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Ooh, that was robust. Opposed, same sign. The amendment passes with flying colors, Representative Burkle. To your bill, as amended.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So as amended, the bill, and now just summarizing it, the need to disclose to buyers before transferring property would be eliminated, and the recording would change for the county recorder. So with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Identify yourselves and proceed.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis, and I represent the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of this bill and thank Representative Burkle for authoring it. As been referenced, House File 1676 would delete the requirement that land where chronic wasting disease has been discovered must be noted on record with the county recorder and register of titles. We believe the language already is covered in subdivision 6 of this article, 2.5 to 2.7, where property, before it can be sold or transferred, it must be disclosed to the buyer all of the requirements in that section of subdivision 11. And therefore, the language in subdivision 7 seems to be duplicative. We went through and started looking at other cases where, unfortunately, we've had some disease among livestock. And when there was bovine TB, we didn't require this of cattle farmers. And when we had PEDV in pork, we didn't require this of pork producers. And when, unfortunately, we've had avian bird flu, we don't require this of turkey farmers. And so finally, before I turn it over to Ms. Hartkopf, I'd like to thank the Minnesota Land Title Association, the Minnesota State Bar Association, the Minnesota Realtors, and the Minnesota Association of County Recorders for their input, advice, and counsel into Representative Hansen and Representative Smith's inquiries. It was working with the State Bar Association and the Land Title Association that they came up with the recommendation for the A1. So that's where that came from, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Ms. Hartkopf, identify yourself and proceed.
Yeah, I'm Brenda Hartkopf with the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association. Chair Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill. This bill addresses one of the frustrations Minnesota elk owners have faced due to the laws that passed in 2023 that greatly hindered our industry. According to the numbers provided by the Board of Animal Health, we lost 26% of our elk operations in 2024 alone. We support striking Subdivision 7, which mandates that a CWD detection be recorded on farm surveyed property deeds for a period of 10 years for several reasons. Redundancy. CWD disclosures are already required in the purchase agreement in Subdivision 6, making it unnecessary to also record them on the property deed. Inconsistency. CWD has been detected in wild deer in 16 Minnesota counties, yet there's no requirement for landowners in these areas to report CWD detections on their property deeds or sale disclosures. It's concerning to us that servant farmers are treated differently than other landowners. Property devaluation. While this language remains on the deed, it could be used to significantly reduce property value. If it is necessary for a CWD detection to be recorded on a servant property deed, why are other landowners not held to the same standard? Other requirements. Servant farms in Minnesota with a CWD detection are required to keep fences in place for 10 years. This is twice the federal recommendation. We have to post biohazard signs and undergo several sanitation measures to mitigate CWD exposure as directed by the Board of Animal Health. There are no requirements for other landowners where CWD positive wild deer have been detected. We are committed to ensuring healthy servant herds on both sides of the fence, but also we want to be treated fairly. We respectfully request your support for House File 1676. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hartkopf. Anybody else in the audience who would care to testify? Identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tim Spreck. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association. I'm also a licensed realtor in the state of Minnesota, so hopefully my experience will provide additional insight on this particular piece of statute that we're looking to remove. What this particular piece of legislation does is it removes the need to record with the county recorder or a registrar of titles when CWD is found on a property. The removed language is redundant and not needed for several reasons. Number one, all homes sold must disclose any material defects. This must be taken care of as a matter of law, no matter what the defect would be. Number two, standard disclosure statements have CWD disclosure already included. So if you sell a property, you're required to fill out a lengthy list of disclosures, whether or not there's a well on the property, a septic system, et cetera, et cetera. There's actually a piece on that disclosure that said, has CWD been found on this property? You check box X for either yes or no. This is already covered as a matter of practice. Number three, it's incumbent on the owner to disclose any material defects on a piece of property, regardless of what they are. So what we currently have is three practices that must be completed by a property owner prior to selling. The piece of statute that we're trying to remove is redundant and not necessary. The removed language is highly damaging to property owners. So for instance, consider this. It places a permanent cloud on the title of the property, makes it very difficult to sell, reduces the land value, and causes additional other problems for the property owner that continue. On the bill, line 2.5 to 2.7, in current statute, along with disclosure requirements already in practice and in law, make this particular piece of legislation or particular piece of statute that we're removing today redundant and unnecessary. Thank you kindly for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Spreck. Any other questions or testifiers on the bill? Seeing none, we'll open it up to member questions. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, this is one of several bills moving through the legislature on attempts to modify, change, or repeal portions of bills that were passed in the last biennium. You know, if this was redundant, it's my understanding, and maybe my memory is incorrect, but we had testimony in the previous biennium about the former Elk Run site that was sold to the Prairie Island Indian community, who did not know that there had been CWD prions detected at that site. So what's the recourse for a purchaser if they did not have that information?
Mr. Quillis, Representative Burkle.
I'm going to also talk to let Ms. Hartkopf respond to this, but Mr. Chairman, under existing law that we've just referenced already in subdivision 6, before signing an agreement to sell or transfer the property, disclose in writing to the buyer the depopulation requirements that were all in that section. So I'm assuming the owners of Elk Run didn't disclose, which would then leave Prairie Island Tribe probably legal remedy to pursue against for not disclosing that they had CWD on that land. But it's required right now under Subdivision 6.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, often with legislation and then becoming law, we do provide clarity because we hear, well, it wasn't clear, I didn't know that, or it wasn't explicit. So then when we make things explicit, then comes, well, it should be more general. We don't need that. And then when it's general, we have people come and say it should be more explicit. You know, the rationale here is, again, for the buyer to know what they're purchasing. And we had testimony over the last several years, and we'll have some more maybe this week, about the persistence of prions and the difference between the wild herd and a business is the business has control of the site. It's a commercial business. And so the responsibility on that site for if there is CWD contamination on that site, the notification, it is buyer beware to make sure that the buyer is aware of what is there if the land is being transferred. So this is an important component of a broad CWD effort. And since we passed this, we know even more about the persistence and the spread of the prion-based chronic wasting disease.
Ms. Harkoff, comment?
I would just, Chair Anderson, Representative Hansen, Chair Hansen, I would just ask the question. I don't know the answer, but do you know how many years it was since the property was sold and that they were looking at it, buying it?
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I should have mentioned that. I think that was before the passage of this law from 2 years ago. I think because it came up, if I remember correctly, I don't know if it was in the last biennium or the biennium before, about that. So that provision was prior to this provision becoming law.
Ms. Harkoff.
Representative Anderson, Chair Hansen, Chair Anderson. Yes, the Elk Run case was in 2009, so it was probably several years after. And it would have, the 10 years might have even passed before this was done. I don't have knowledge exactly of the dates, but I would guess that a timing issue was part of that also.
Further questions or comments on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Burkle, any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that we're just laying this bill over. I would just also mention that, you know, if you go back to Subdivision 11, there's also requirements to maintain fencing for 10 years, post-fencing with biohazard signs. I would think anyone purchasing property would notice that. So I think this is redundant and duplicative, and I think it's a good bill to clean things up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Burkle moves that House File 1676, as amended, be laid over. And you can stay there, Representative. House File 40, Representative Burkle, once again, requiring fencing requirements. Representative Burkle, to your bill. I'd move House File 40.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 40 to be laid over. I'm introducing House File 40 here, and I just want to touch, of course, this touches on deer farming, but also I think, you know, keep in mind the understanding that this is not just about deer farmers, but really farmers in the state and their right to farm. We all know that farmers and livestock producers work tirelessly, and we all know that deer farmers are no different. And we've recognized that fact, actually, in Minnesota statute. If you go to statute 17.452, where we actually recognize deer farming in subdivision 5 and subdivision 4. Raising farm survey is agricultural production and agricultural pursuit. So a lot of what we've done in the past couple of years has really inhibited where a deer farmers stand as far as being recognized as agricultural producers. House File 40 would change some of the statutes currently pertaining to secondary fencing. And so in Subdivision 4, the statute currently reads that farm survey fencing must ensure animals are confined. in a manner designed to prevent escape, which is reasonable, and the fencing must be 8 feet tall and be designated to prevent entry or escape from the premises, which is reasonable. So my bill would strike the language regarding the physical contact between Server Day and free roaming Server Day, and that secondary fence requirement. Also on lines 2.1 and 2.5 through 2.5, would strike the language that allows the harsh rule of revocation of a farm's registration and the DNR's ability to seize and destroy animals on the facility. So if a deer farmer simply is follow the rule here and happens to have a deer escape, it doesn't even say the deer farm is infected or positive with CWD. The DNR can, if they want, go in and take that deer herd and destroy those healthy animals. If a cattle farmer doesn't follow a rule, they might pay a fine, but their cattle aren't taken away from them and destroyed. So with that, I'd like to turn this over to my testifiers, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Welcome again, Ms. Harkoff. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, members of the committee. Brenda Harkoff with the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association. I want to thank Representative Burkle for bringing House File 40 forward and for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill. As Executive Secretary of the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association, I've heard from nearly every member about their frustration with the 2023 requirement to add a physical barrier preventing contact between farmed and wild cervidae. This provision is the primary reason breeders are leaving the industry. With many breeders who have had decades of great compliance and surveillance now forced to exit the industry. While intended to prevent physical contact, the barrier's effectiveness is questionable. We've seen examples of closed, double-fenced herds that still detected CWD, and no other state mandates such a barrier on all the breeder farms. Many elk breeders are still struggling with this requirement, facing significant financial burdens due to the unfunded mandate. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture's limited grant assistance was helpful and appreciated, but it hasn't fully covered the costs. And adding the barrier can also be challenging due to fences that have been up for decades, where trees and brush have grown along the fence, making this an even more labor-intensive and expensive project. Age and physical limitations for some breeders have made the project unmanageable. While some breeders have successfully added barriers to their entire facility, others have had to sell some of their animals to lower their numbers and not use their outer ring pastures in order to comply. We also have concerns about the provision allowing the seizure and destruction of animals after more than one escape incident or uncorrected fence deficiencies. Destroying a breeder's livelihood in such cases could be seen as too harsh depending upon the situation. We all share the goal of eliminating CWD, but driving breeders out of business isn't the solution. There is still time to make this better for those who are still in the business. We ask for your support of House File 40. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Other testifiers, Tim Sprecht or Scott Fear or Lieutenant Colonel Gorecki? Welcome back. Identify yourselves and proceed.
Good afternoon again, Madam or Mr. Chair and members. Sorry. My name is Tim Spreck. I'm here again representing the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association. House File 40 is just a pretty simple bill. What it does is it removes the reference to physical contact in statute. Physical contact is not what it sounds like. What it sounds like is that we're taking down all the fences, and that's not what we're up to. According to the DNR interpretation of what would be required to comply with this statute, the deer farmers were provided this particular pamphlet. What it has is four different options, most of which are extremely expensive, very hard to comply with, and also ambiguous in their nature. The most important thing about this is when we turn to the last page, and you should have this in your packet, the statements in this document did not have the force of law. This document is informational only and should not be interpreted as creating new criteria or requirements beyond what is already established in the current in the relevant statutes and rules. Whether an individual facility complies with the relevant statutes and rules will be determined on a case-by-case basis. Nothing in this document should be considered legal advice. So here's what we've got. We've got a statute that was very hard to interpret. The DNR did what they did in interpreting it, provided this document to the deer farmers, and then told them, oh, by the way, if you do comply with this at great cost, it may not be good enough and it may fail. So what are we doing to the deer farmers here? We're putting them in a position that's untenable, where they can never comply, and as a result, we can drive them out of business. And currently, farmers are being fined. Mr. Fear is going to talk to you a little bit more additionally about that when he comes up. The bill also removes the revocation of license and destruction of animal language from statute. Escapes result from forces outside of the deer farmers' control, oftentimes weather-related, where they don't have any idea that an animal has escaped. And as a result of this, they could be fined, punitively damaged, and have their animals taken and destroyed. Both provisions in this bill are either impossible to comply with, needlessly costly, or result in the taking of property for a minor infraction. Mr. Chair, we thank Representative Burkle for taking this on and authoring this bill to help the servant farmers of Minnesota, and we would appreciate support. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Fear, identify yourself, and let's hear your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Scott Fear. I'm president of the Minnesota Deer Farmers. I'm here to testify on behalf or in support of this bill, 110%. These fencing provisions have been very devastating for our industry. As a president, I field calls daily. People are struggling financially, mentally, emotionally. How can we afford this fence? You know, if I talk on my behalf, I mean, the cheapest version of this fence, which I think is very ineffective, would be around $50,000 just for my farm, in excess of a fence.
You say 15 or 50?
50, 50. By the time you do labor, brush removal, whatnot, I have a very large farm. I understand some of the smaller farms maybe have been able to comply or maybe had fence up already. But for me, like I said, it'd be $50,000 minimum, upwards of $700,000-$800,000 on a business that seems to be going to the wayside. Especially with these regulations, like Mr. Spreck was mentioning there too, we got these four guidelines that they're good today, but yet it's on a case-by-case basis. So my farm might pass this year. If I get a different CO come inspect my farm next year, he may say, no, that it don't pass. So I just spent that $50,000, and next year it don't pass. You know, the goalposts keep moving on us. It's hard to get any concrete direction on what we're supposed to be doing, who's our contact person. We've had numerous people send in drawings of, you know, to the DNR on would this fence work. You know, apparently that goes to some fence committee in the DNR that I'm unaware of, nor are any of us a part of it either on this committee, but everyone has been denied. And at this time, I know there's at least 8 producers, including myself, that's in a notice of violation, a $500 fine, plus my $250 reinspection fee for something that I cannot afford to do. You know, we feel like our 8-foot high fence, we contain our animals. We're following state and federal guidelines. You know, we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, but yet this double fence puts another dagger in our back. It feels like we're trying to be pushed out of business. And keep in mind, our businesses are all derived around marginal land or wasteland where people I found ways to make a living with this land, myself included. You know, this has been devastating. It's kind of hard to talk about, to be honest, because it's very emotional for a lot of us and heartbreaking. This has been my dream for all my life, to do what I'm doing, and I've been doing it for 25 years, and I'm being kicked out based on over-regulations. And this one's the dagger, I tell you. This is what's getting most of us out of business. Keep in mind, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I don't remember the exact dates, but Minnesota had the most number of surveyed farms in America. We had, at that time, over $25 million revenue for our state. We're 10 years down the road now. Now, where could we be as a state as far as revenue? And on top of that, in combating CWD, finding the actual real cause of CWD, doing helping working with us dear farmers on finding a cure to CWD or where it's coming from, how it's being transmitted. You know, and I think that's what a lot of this is with this double fence, is there's no data that supports two deer looking at each other through a fence or bumping noses will contract CWD. Nowhere in the world that I'm aware of that can happen. So what are we doing? I think as a state here, ourselves, myself included, working with the University of Minnesota, we're going to work on some, with rodents, coons, other scavengers, squirrels, rabbits. How is CWD being spread? You know, because to me, it's not just deer to deer. As mentioned previously, too, we have numerous farms in the country that have CWD-infected pens, but yet the pens next to them are not being not contracted with CWD. So how can that be? They've been there, been living together for 3, 4, 5 years, but one pen has and one doesn't. You know, and they can touch nose to nose if they want. So where's it really coming from? I think we need to follow the science. I think we need to give this more time. And with that, I'll close with, I support this bill 100%. And if anyone has any questions, I'll feel free to ask. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Fair. Our last official testifier, at least by my record here, is Lieutenant Colonel Robert Gorecki. Sir, identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Gorecki, Assistant Director for the DNR Enforcement Division. I'll keep my comments brief. The DNR has concerns about changes proposed in this bill. This bill will not only remove the requirement for to prevent physical contact between wild deer and farm deer, but removes the penalties for failing to follow surveyed fencing and escape regulations. With this bill, wild deer and farm deer would be able to have nose-to-nose contact, again, what we're trying to prevent in the first place, and potentially increase the chances of transmission of CWD both directions. Removing the potential penalty of revocation in particular would leave little to no consequences to incentivize farmers to maintain their fences and prevent escapes. If there is a producer who flat out refuses to follow fencing guidelines, including fencing rules that have been in place for decades, neither the Board of Animal Health nor the DNR could take action against their herd registrations or take any serious actions against the producer to ensure compliance. This bill would substantially negate the purpose of farm deer regulations, since the consequences for noncompliance would be limited to monetary penalties, which a noncompliant farmer would keep paying without fixing underlying violations. If farmers don't feel the need to fix underlying violations, this also increases opportunities for the spread of CWD. Overall, this bill would increase the likelihood of CWD spread. It should be noted, we're only out of whitetail deer farms. There's only 10 farms that are not in compliance with the regulations currently. And I'll stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Colonel. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gorecki, when you go visit a farm, do you find outside the fence just a path in some cases where wild deer are going back and forth along the perimeter?
Lieutenant Colonel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, that is very common at these facilities.
Chair Hansen.
And Mr. Gorecki, when prior to this law being passed a couple years ago, seemed like every fall there were deer that were harvested with ear tags in them. And, you know, we knew that there are no naturally occurring ear tags in wild deer. Since the passage of this law, have there been any deer harvested in Minnesota with ear tags in them?
Lieutenant Colonel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, there has. It should be noted, since 2023, escapes have been drastically down. We only had 3 in 2023 and 2 in 2024, I believe.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with those ear tag deer, was that a good indicator to find out where there had been a flaw in the fence?
Lieutenant Colonel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes. In fact, most of those deer are unreported until they're harvested by a farmer.
Lieutenant Colonel, I have one quick question. I've heard that you had put out, or DNR had put out, kind of suggestions for fences. Is there a standard fence that the DNR approves and says, yes, if you do this, you will be approved? Is there some kind of a standardized suggestion for deer farmers?
Mr. Chair, no, there is not. It is a case-by-case basis. The reason for that is every farm has a different topography, landscape situation, so they're handled on a case-by-case basis. The guidelines that the DNR provided are just suggestions that will, in most cases, get people to be compliant with the current regulations. However, they're encouraged to submit suggestions or proposals to the DNR, to our wildlife biologists, who will review them, approve those changes and modifications if they're appropriate to prevent physical contact, or offer suggestions on how to alter their proposal and still meet the need for the physical contact regulations prohibition.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the DNR again. You said that there's only 10 farms right now that are out of compliance, so are you working with those farms to get them back into compliance, and how is that process going?
Lieutenant Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we continue to work with them. We're continuing to encourage them to become compliant. Some are choosing just not to do anything and wait out the federal litigation that's currently ongoing. Other than that, we can continue to encourage them to follow state regulations at this time.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I think it's important to note that, you know, at least some of them are trying to get into compliance. And then I think, as you were saying, it sounds as if this law that we recently passed is sort of working towards that effort to slow down the transmission of CWD. So I would think that this bill might be a little bit premature and kind of stopping a process that we are actually wanting to make sure that we have a healthier deer herd here in Minnesota. So thank you.
Comment, Representative Burke, Mr. Fear.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I find that to be false, that there's not enough data or not enough time to support her question, that we think we're slowing down CWD. We don't know that. Nobody knows that. I think there's a double standard here. You know, us as producers, we put up our fence to keep our animal confined, just like a hog producer, cattle producer, any other animal. If we're so worried about the wild deer getting CWD from our CWD, we are certified clean herds by federal regulation. We test all of our deer when they die. I've raised deer for 25 years, had hundreds of deer die, never had one positive, nor will I probably ever. And I will go on record saying that. Another comment on the path along the fence line that was made before. That could be true. It could be deer, but yet we've also done with the University of Minnesota, we did a camera study here. One summer or two summers ago now. I think we compiled it was either 5 to 7 years worth of surveillance with hundreds of cameras, and the report came back that we had it was either 5 or 7 incidental contacts. That could be just looking at each other through the fence. So we're not talking about a major, you know, like herds of deer walking along our fence lines, touching noses. I mean, it's actually kind of rare. And the cost, if we're so worried about the wild deer touching our clean USDA certified herds, why does the producer have to pay for that cost? To me, it feels like a double. There should be, when the state or the DNR cover that cost, we're doing our job that we've been doing all along, and now we're throwing this up against us as well. It just feels like a dagger financially to get rid of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fear. Any closing comments, Representative Burkle?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say that, you know, we've always, you know, the saying, good fences make good neighbors. Where I come from, sometimes those costs are split. And in this case, I would say, and I believe in the Senate, a similar bill was heard, and there was an amendment added to have the state pay for the secondary fencing. But as things stand, the current statute is just unjust, and frankly, it's a regulatory taking of these farms' livelihoods. And I think this legislation begins the process of fixing the issue and allows a legal farm enterprise to continue to operate. And I'll refer you once again to 17.452, which says that these are actually agricultural animals. Farm servitude are livestock and are not wild animals. I'm quoting that. So that members, there's a need to way to figure this out, and we can continue to work with deer farmers and all farmers in general. And this is what our House Ag Committee should really be about. So I'm going to leave it there and thank the committee for the opportunity to expose this threat to our legislatively legal farming operations in this state. And that's under statute. And thank you for hearing the bill, and thank you for laying it over.
With that, we'll lay over House File 40. Thanks, Representative Burkle. We're going to jump down to our last item here to get this one done. Representative Kabke, I believe, is here. Good. House File 1540. It's a residency pilot program. Welcome, Representative. We've got about 15, maybe 17 minutes left, so do your best. And I will move House File 1540 before the committee. Representative Tabke, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair Anderson. I very much hope to not take 15 or 17 minutes, but that's up to everyone else here. So thank you, Chair Hansen and members, for hearing this bill today. So Canterbury Park is a major economic driver, job producer in our community, is really important to the fabric of who we are in Shakopee, and as well has a massive economic impact across the state of Minnesota. So it's the horse racing industry is not just horses, it's all everything that goes along with that of raising feed, of veterinarians, of everything from there all through the racing operations and getting it there. And so, as everyone knows, racing has been struggling in Minnesota for a variety of reasons that we get into if you'd like to as we go forward. But it's really important that we make sure that this industry is successful and is great, not just for the economics of the state of Minnesota, because it's also fun and a major entertainment producer in our area. And so we have a bill today that I'll walk through really quickly here. It's a residency bill, and it's to reward and to promote horses that live and are raised in the state of Minnesota. And so we want as many horses from Minnesota to make sure that that industry is as successful and as strong as possible. And so what this does is $3.5 million a year for 2 years as a pilot program to anytime a horse that is Minnesota bred and Minnesota owned is raced in Shakopee, that horse therefore is automatically eligible to receive $750 for racing. And it's to make sure that we are racing Minnesota horses and to make sure that industry is as strong as possible. And so there are a couple other nuance and caveats, but we'll take questions for those after we have a couple testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thanks, Representative. Your testifiers. Whoever's first, identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew Dewar, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association. Thank you for hearing the bill, and thank you, Representative Tabke, for bringing this bill forward. And such a great introduction. I can save you some time. I can skip a lot of this. But House File 1540 is a bill that provides the opportunity to attract and keep more thoroughbreds in Minnesota, increase economic and agricultural benefits to the state, and provides support services to those who work with these animals on the backstretch at Canterbury Park. First, why agriculture? We're used to talking about pigs, cows, and chickens in this committee, but horses and other equines are also defined as livestock in Minnesota statute, Chapter 17. And I think all the farmers in the room here that have worked and raised horses will definitely agree with that statement. The horse industry's impact on agriculture and the products and services consumed is substantial. The average thoroughbred will consume about 25 pounds of feed a day. And on any given day, you can see trailer loads of hay, feed, bedding, and other products being delivered to the Canterbury Park stable area. You'll also see trailers hauling horses, veterinary trucks visiting each barn, and countless other services that contribute to the community at the track. Representative Tabke already mentioned the economic benefits and kind of how the residency program works. One piece that I'll also mention that's in the latter half of the bill is another section of this bill would support and expand existing educational and mental health programs for the backside community. Furlong Learning, it's a program at Canterbury Park that provides tutoring and other educational opportunities for pre-K to 12th grade kids in the backside area. And these are by licensed teachers that stay at Canterbury Park. This program also provides ESL programs to adults on the backside. Abijah's on the Backside is an equine mental health program that's been helping stable workers and first responders with holistic support for depression, addiction, and anxiety with the help of these incredibly intuitive animals. In fact, in other committees at the Capitol here that have had hearings on Abijah's, we've heard some pretty powerful testimony by first responders that have said that Abijah has literally saved their life. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll end my testimony by offering an invitation to anyone on the committee to come out and to the next meet and see Canterbury for yourself. I looking around the room, I see some members of the committee that have been on some of those tours. We do one on the front side on race day if you're interested in seeing how Canterbury works on a race day and possibly wager on a few races. But we also do a backside tour for people to meet the workers, see the horses, and see the incredibly vibrant and passionate community that lives in the stable area. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Thanks, Mr. Dewar. Next up, we have Justin Revac?
Correct.
Go ahead. Identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Justin Revac, and I am the president of the Minnesota Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association. I'm also a racehorse owner and a resident of Shakopee, so I'm a constituent of Mr. Representative Tabke here. I want to thank Representative Tabke for entering this bill and to the committee for hearing us out. You know, I think there was some pages distributed. On page 3, this titled Thoroughbred Racehorses Are a Mobile Sports Franchise. And I think that's really a good way of looking at the industry, because as a horse owner, breeder, trainer, you really, when you acquire a horse, you can take it to whatever track in the country that you see fit to take it to. And the three factors, there's lots of different factors that go into that decision, but the three primary ones are, number one, purses. Number two is sort of where your home track is, and number three is the quality of life for the people at the track. So when it comes to purses, Canterbury has struggled for the last few years as our purses have declined. You know, some other states are at a little bit more of an advantage because they receive more incentives, whether that be from gambling proceeds or from just distributions from the state or certain programs like this one that this is designed after. As far as the home track, you know, people just like to see their horses run where they live. Canterbury has an extremely loyal group of horsemen, owners and trainers that many have been racing here since the 80s. But when you factor that in and then purses declining, that loyalty only goes so far before you can't make an honest business out of it and continue racing here. From a quality of life perspective at Canterbury, we're really second to none there. You know, the facilities are great, whether it's on the front side or the back side. You know, Shakopee's a great area. A lot of racetracks you go to are in areas of town that not very many people want to go to. You know, Shakopee's completely different. There's lots of growth happening in Shakopee, lots of new, you know, the amphitheater and new restaurants coming into town. And then when you combine that with the programs that AJ mentioned and a lot of the things that the HBPA does to enhance the quality of life for people on the backside, it really sets us at an advantage there that helps to offset some of our purse challenges. I would like to point out that 100% of the funds from this bill would go to the horsemen. It wouldn't go to Canterbury Park. Even so, I know Randy Sampson, CEO of Canterbury, has submitted a letter supporting this bill. So in summary, I'd say this bill increases purses to attract more horses to Canterbury, enhances the backside programs that we're able to establish, and also provides money for retired racehorses, which is another important factor, that we have a safe place for these horses to land and then continue to contribute to the agricultural community here in Minnesota. So I hope that you'll consider the bill for inclusion in your budget, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Revac. Anybody in the audience who would care to testify? Seeing none, on the committee questions of Representative Lawrence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Tabke. Just a quick question under Subdivision 4. As I read that, and more clarification for me than anything else, as I read that, every horse that is raced in Canterbury that day would receive $750,
or do they have to be Minnesota-owned and for every race following? So every time there's a race day, there would be a payout of $750 for the horses raced at Canterbury.
Representative Tabke?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lawrence, so thank you very much for that. If you back up just a little bit and look at Subdivision 3, so start at line 120, there, that is the beginning of the registry for the residency program. And so in those sections, it creates the registration, so that would happen this calendar year, and then the following calendar year, the residency awards for anybody who's a registered under that subdivision for racing at Canterbury would get $750 as an initial purse for racing. Yes.
Representative Lawrence, follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just one further clarification, Representative Tabke. Is it $750 per the applicant or $750 per the racehorses? I mean, so if an applicant has five racehorses, they'd receive five times the money?
Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lawrence. It is per horse that races.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
Anybody else? Representative Smith.
Apologize. Thank you, Representative Tabke. Just to be quick, clarifying, every single racing day that horse races on that calendar year will get that $750 payout that is reimbursed through this fund. Correct?
Representative Tabke?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, yes. So every time a horse races, and that could be, and Justin could probably help with this a little better than I could, a horse could race any time between there's a couple weeks between races to more than a month between races. And so it doesn't race every single meet. And so as that horse races, it's to make sure that we are incentivizing and pushing the economic development of the industry in Minnesota.
Representative Smith.
Just a quick follow-up. I don't know anything about horse racing. So maybe just like, what's like an average horse like that might be at the Shakopee racetrack for, I don't know, how many racing days is this horse gonna run potentially for this award?
Mr. Rivak, I think you're being phoned a friend there.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Smith. So the average horse at Thoroughbred at Canterbury races 4 to 5 times per season. It's about 2 to 4 weeks between races typically for a horse.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just checking, would this continue to track the horses, say, if they go to the Amish market, or I know there's no, I don't think there's any nationally approved horse slaughter facility, but how long do you track after retirement?
Mr. Rivak?
As far as tracking, so we work with multiple rehoming rehabilitation programs, such as This Old Horse and Bowman's Second Chance. So almost all of our horses that when they need to retire during the season go to one of those organizations, and then it's their responsibility from there to ensure that their safety going forward.
Okay. Thank you. I've been down there a couple of times and thoroughly enjoyed it down to Canterbury. And, you know, we've talked before about the benefit that the racetrack has, not only for entertainment, but Mr. Dewar mentioned the ag impact. A lot of hay, a lot of grass hay, alfalfa hay, and a lot of oats down there. It does have a significant impact on ag, at least in that part of the state. And the veterinarians, the horses are well taken care of, and It's a fun place to go. Any other final comments from members? Hearing none, your final comments, Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And so thank you, everyone, for hearing this bill today. I really appreciate your time and hope that this gets included in a final budget, because, like I said, this is really important to our community. There's an extraordinary on the backside. So, again, as Mr. Dewar said, welcome everybody to come to Canterbury. I know we've had lots of tours with folks, and so anybody else who would like to have a tour, please let me know and we can get this figured out. But it's a really important community, and as you said, Mr. Chair, like veterinarians, for example, we know we have a massive shortage of large animal veterinarians across the state of Minnesota, and this is an incredible way where we can make sure that there's a basis for those veterinarians and make sure that this money gets pumped into our ag economy, and I hope to have everyone's support as this moves forward.
When does your season start, racing season start?
It starts around Memorial Day. I'm not sure this year what the first day is.
A Memorial Day weekend, Saturday.
Very good.
It's my my event after we're done with session.
See no further comments. With that, I would renew the motion from Representative Tabke that House File 1540 be laid over.
Thank you.
And with that, members, we got a pretty good job done today. The meeting is adjourned.